Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guest is Dale Phoenix. Dale has recently relocated from the beautiful Sierra Nevada foothills to the North Bay area. Dale is a writer, artist, community educator, and personal liberation coach.
When Dale isn't creating, he is a therapist who works with the LGBTQ plus community in a private practice part-time and in the field of addiction recovery full-time. Dale has two poetry books and a poetry CD published under their former name, and they are a former broadcaster who still occasionally moonlights at KOWSLP in Occidental, bringing you music and spoken word that uplifts the soul. Hey, Dale.
Hi, nice to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are so looking forward to speaking with you, Dale, in more detail and learning about your life. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of October 6, 2024. The state of Colorado will reportedly pay more than $1.5 million in legal fees to an anti-LGBTQ plus web designer who won the right to discriminate in the landmark Supreme Court case 303 Creative versus Alenis. In a statement, Brian Niehart, senior counsel for the anti-LGBTQ hate group Alliance Defending Freedom, who represented Smith, defended the practice of the victor in a civil rights case seeking legal fees from the losing side. He said, quote, "Our clients Lori Smith and her design studio prevailed at the Supreme Court and achieved a landmark victory, a victory that helps protect all Americans' freedom of speech from government censorship and coercion," end quote. The case started in 2016 after Smith, who's a Christian web designer, sued the state of Colorado over its anti-discrimination law. The Supreme Court ruled that some small businesses have a free speech right to refuse service based on their personal beliefs. Smith had argued that her free speech was being stifled because she wanted to get into the wedding website business without serving LGBTQ plus customers because she believes, quote, "God is calling her to promote and celebrate his design for marriage between one man and one woman," end quote. The court said that Colorado's LGBTQ plus inclusive anti-discrimination law cannot be enforced against her for refusing to make websites for same-sex couples, even if she's making similar websites for opposite-sex couples. And here in California, public libraries will no longer be able to pull books off the shelf because they talk about race or sexual orientation. And those receiving state funding will now be required to have a written policy governing how they add titles and remove titles from their collections. This is all due to Assembly Bill 1825, which Governor Newsom signed into law to become effective on January 1st. It prevents other public libraries in the state from removing books from their collections or banning the purchase of new books related to subject matters like LGBTQ plus issues and race. Books also can't be banned because of views, ideas, or opinions contained in the material. Book banning proponents are disproportionately targeting materials containing the voices and lived experiences of LGBTQ plus people and communities of color. The new law will prevent officials in Fresno County who've been attempting to remove books deemed not suitable for children from the children's section of their public libraries. And if you're not yet registered to vote in this November's critical election, there's still time. Among the many other important issues and offices is California's Proposition 3, which proposes to remove the language from California's Constitution limiting marriage to one man and one woman. You may recall that voters put this language in the Constitution back in 2008. Marriage equality was restored to California in 2013, but only because of a court order, which could be easily overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Proposition 3 ensures marriage equality for all. The deadline to register to vote is October 21st, and you can do it pretty easily online at registertovote.ca.gov. And don't forget about the many events happening this week that you're invited to attend. First, the author of a new biography of trailblazing journalist Randy Schultz is starting his book tour here in the Bay Area with two events open to all members of the public free of charge. First, you can meet author Michael Lee at New Technology High School in Napa at 7 p.m. this coming Thursday. His next stop will be at Russian River Books this coming Saturday, October 12th, also at 7 p.m. I'll be moderating a conversation with Michael at both events, and copies of his book will be available for purchase and signing. You can learn more about locations and details on our website at outbeatnews.com. And also, longtime activist and now Sonoma County resident Cleve Jones is celebrating his 70th birthday this coming Friday. He's throwing a big party in San Francisco as a fundraiser for two organizations he was part of creating, that being the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and AIDS Memorial Quilt. The party will take place starting at 8 p.m. this Friday, October 11th, at the Hibernia Bank Building at Jones and Market Street. Tickets are available for sale. This is a fundraiser, don't forget. Just go to clevejones70.com. That's CLEVEJones70.com. If you have a local LGBTQ news story, announcement, or an event you'd like to share with our listeners in this segment, tell us about it by going to our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click the Submit Event button at the top of the page. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. But I don't know what to do.
And if you just joined us, we are talking with Del Phoenix. And again, Del, we want to thank you so much for giving us a little bit of time out of your very busy schedule.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So we are wondering, what brought you to the North Bay? You said you relocated from the Sierra Hills?
Yeah, Sierra Nevada foothills. I was living in Grass Valley for 17 years. And I have, you know, friends in the area. I had a relationship in the area quite some time ago and kept coming out here. I made a connection with the area, specifically the ocean and the redwoods, that really just, I don't know, probably from the first or second time I traveled out here, I felt like I was home already. And it took a few years, but I started realizing, you know, this is where I wanted to be, and took a few more years of trying to figure out, you know, how that was going to happen. And last year, you know, this thing started lining up in my life. Things were aligning really to bring me here. So I moved here in December of 2023 and yeah, just getting settled.
Well, what kind of things aligned?
Oh, yeah. So living in the Sierra Nevada foothills, fire season. We had a fire 2 years ago near my house, and I lost my home insurance a year later. So I had to start doing a lot of work on my house that, you know, I'd owned my home for 15 years. So at the time, the cost was pretty low. But by the time I had all that work done, my mortgage and loans were about the same as what I'm paying here for the cost of living. It's like, okay, so that tells me I can do it. But I was also, I was comfortable with where I was financially, but I would not have been able to make those bills and make more money with where I was living in a very rural area, working with the queer community. I was working in Sacramento 3 days a week and from home 2 days a week at the time, doing telehealth. And it was bringing in, like I said, enough to be comfortable, but not enough to bring in that extra that I needed. So I was like, okay, it sounds like it's time. I also started just feeling like I was done with what, you know, I was complete with what I was brought to Grass Valley for.
So I'm just curious about the LGBTQ plus community there. How big is it?
it's not super big. It's I was a board member for Nevada County Pride in 2023, and we did a needs assessment for the community, and we got about 125, 29 responses somewhere in there for the needs assessment. And I know that there were a lot more people who did not fill it out, you know, but even for such a small community, it's thriving, you know, which could not be said even 5 years ago. So, you know, 5 years ago, it's still very closeted, very small. There were regular get-togethers with some of the elders in the community that had been there for a long time. But the youth were very separated from the community. Families, you know, didn't have the resources they need. And over the last 5 years, all of that started coming to fruition in the area.
We're curious. We talked about it when you send over your all your information about yourself. I don't want to tell your age. You can tell that, but you're not looking at you. You're not so, you know, old. So you've, I mean, you've done so much. I'm just so impressed. We are so impressed. We talked about it. It's like this Dale person is like, how do you do it? Where do you find your energy? What's your drive? What, you know?
Good question. So I'm 45, so not super young, not super old. I've always pretty much always been the younger one in my social groups. I feel like that's starting to even out a little bit now. Wow, what gives me my energy, my drive? I think just a constant need for growth and change and forward movement in my life is part of it. Some of the things that I've done long-term, like radio, are grounding for me. Like I started in radio as a way to connect with music as my own like spiritual and grounding practice when I was going through a very rough part of my life. And that stuck with me. And then I stayed with it and joined the board of the station as a way to give back what was given to me, and you know, continued to have shows there until I moved here. Part of what brought me out here initially were connections with KOWS, and I've done some moonlighting there since I think 2016-ish. You know, just here and there subbing for a couple of friends on the station. So that's also, it's been nice to have KOWS because it's a little bit more grassroots than KVMR was. KVMR is still a community radio station. It's not as big as NPR stations are, but so there's still a lot of focus on free speech and things like that. But KVMR was definitely in the process of growing up and becoming more professional and more grounded in its own identity. So,
oh, I'd love to tap into your show sometime, but you don't have a regular slot on KOWS.
No, right now I just
sub. You just sub, yeah. For your.
I just sub for a couple friends there. I hope when I'm once I'm grounded in the community here that I can pick up a regular show. So,
You gotta watch what you say.
I've already had some offers.
Oh, okay. So see,
it's more about just me having to listen to my own capacity right now. You know, I am working full time, one full time job and one part time job. So, I don't have a lot of extra time right now.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your work? Okay.
So I'm a therapist. I have just finished my licensure hours for LCSW. So I'm just, you know, I'm waiting for the state to finish, you know, their end of things so I can take the exam and break off into my own private practice. I love private practice. I also love working, you know, in addiction recovery, but I really feel that private practice is where it's at for me. One of the things that I've learned working my full-time job now is that I love to teach. And so I'm hoping to include that somehow.
What did you teach?
So in my full-time job, I mostly do psychoeducational classes and process groups, as well as individual sessions. And I've, before taking that job, for the last 5 years, I've been doing gender diversity education for social service organizations, and the like. And all of that has coalesced into like this love for teaching. It's just not something I want to do full-time.
Very interesting. So gender, what did you say?
Gender diversity.
Gender diversity training. So if somebody were to be listening to our show right now, how would you describe what gender diversity trainings are? And then how do you answer the questions of the elders around gender?
Oh, interesting. Okay. So, so gender diversity education, I mostly work with social service organizations. I've worked with some medical and therapy groups as well, and just learning how to make their practices more transgender friendly, and to give people a basic 101 idea of what gender diversity is. So understanding the difference between biological sex and gender as a social construction. And then gender identity is broken down into identity, which is how we see ourselves, roles, which is what society expects of us based on what we're assigned at birth, and then our expression, which is literally just how we express that gender. And for most people, like 97% of the population, all of those things are in alignment with each other. Nothing wrong with that. But for the 3% of us who don't meet those traditional roles, expression, and identities, you know, it hasn't been safe for most of history in Western culture, at least, to have differences in our gender identity. So, you know, I walk people through understanding those on those different levels. There's also intersex people who are, you know, can be transgender, can be cis, depending on how they identify. But, you know, they have to figure out for themselves where they fit in to this binary structure that we have as a society. So I discuss a little bit of that. I discuss things like, you know, systemic barriers to growth and success and privilege and intersectionality in those trainings. And then for the social service organizations and clinicians, I go a little bit deeper into how to work specifically with the trans and non-binary community in terms of, you know, like how to set up paperwork, you know, questions around name, pronouns, and how to navigate things like insurance, which may or be different than what people present. And then also, like specifically with therapists, types of interventions to use, you know, in terms of best practices.
Wow, that's a lot in that title and the work that you do with gender diversity. I love that. Yeah,
I do too.
I mean, I'm just curious how you come across with all this knowledge to your audience. How are they accepting it?
I mean, for the most part, I get great reception. I probably do about 3 or 4 trainings a year on average, so not a whole lot, but it's enough to keep me busy and keep me growing and doing more research as we expand in terms of our understandings. I started with focusing on gender diversity education with my internship in grad school, which was at the Gender Health Center in Sacramento. And at the time, we were providing training for UC Davis medical students. And so from that, I was able to expand, you know, plus my education. My undergraduate work was in sociology with a focus on gender and sexuality studies. And my graduate school was a master's in social work with a focus on LGBT studies and trauma. So.
So you created your own workshop and your own, yeah, curriculum for this.
I did.
Wow, beautiful. Wow. Was that part of your graduate work? Your thesis or something?
No, it wasn't. All of my research that I did in grad school focused on the intersections of LGBT identities and trauma, and also some of the intersections there. So like I did a paper on accessibility in queer spaces and how, you know, we have a larger number or percentage of disabled people within the LGBTQ community, but we don't have very many accessible spaces, you know, in part due to funding and in part due to differences in approaches. So like the elders and the people that tend to be more on the, you know, cisgender binary end of things don't have the understanding, but they control a lot of the funding, you know, mm-hmm. for the needs of, you know, those who are at the bottom of the, you know, the social hierarchy, basically, with disabilities and more marginalized identities. So, mm-hmm. you know, intersections of race, disability, you know, financial location, things like that.
So Del, I'm just sitting here listening to all this. It's just really mind-boggling, all the information that you have in your brain cells. I'm wondering you did your undergraduate work in gender studies, right? Is that what you said?
Sociology with a focus on gender and sexuality. Yeah.
Gender and so what brought you to this line of work, this line of study, where you're very, very prolific in your thoughts and your writings and your passion and your work? What brought you?
Okay, so let's see, I came out as trans when I was 35. I initially came out as bi when I was 12. So I had already been in and around the community for several years, you know, mostly in my teenage years. And then In my 20s, I ended up in a relation in mostly straight presenting relationships and just kind of got out of the community. And then when I moved to Grass Valley, I had a homophobic experience pretty shortly after I moved there that just sent me into the closet where I wasn't open about any of my identity at the time. And it took about 10 years for me to start dating within community again. And to come out again as bi. And then a few more years before coming out as non-binary trans. And I kind of go back and forth with those two terms for myself. I am trans masculine. However, I see myself as more non-binary. I don't really fit into, I definitely don't fit into like the typical Western idea of masculinity. I think most people read me as a very flamboyant, queer man. So when they meet me. And then the other parts of me that are masculine, parts of me that are very feminine. And all of that makes up who I am. And I can't ignore any of it. I can't suppress it. And I don't want to. So in that respect, I identify as non-binary. So, but I do use they or he pronouns, just mostly to make it easier. I don't want to have to provide a gender 101, for everybody that come across who doesn't understand they them. And there are days that he actually does feel pretty affirming for me, so it's all good.
I'm sorry to hear about your experience that sent you back into the closet for 10 years.
10 years,
I'm wondering, I'm feeling like suspecting that you feel safe here in
I do.
Sonoma County.
I do actually. That's part of why Sonoma County is so important to me, because I came out and started transitioning after being introduced to Sonoma County, and this was where I initially came and started presenting as masculine and started really starting to experience myself. Grass Valley is a beautiful place. There are a lot of wonderful people there. When I moved there in 2006, it was 93 or 97% white. Now it's 97 or 93%. So it's, like a little bit of growth in terms of racial diversity. And I know in terms of, queer community, we've had a lot of people move there in recent years, and a lot of kids who are coming out that are, while they're living there and not leaving the community. But for the most part, when I moved there, it was still very conservative and not safe to be out. I also started my transition during the pandemic, which I think helped some of that. So, in terms of safety and feeling confident in, in understanding who I am and feeling where my expression, was felt authentic, before presenting it to the larger community when I was at home. So, but Sonoma County was the place where I could be open and be myself and feel safe.
Well, good for you.
That's
Good for
wonderful to
Sonoma
hear.
County. Yes. Yeah.
So you are a poet. And can you talk to us a little bit about your poetry and how you, what kind of, you've published two poetry books and a poetry CD. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I started writing poetry. I think my first poem I wrote in sixth grade. It was very much aligned with like Robert Frost's meter and rhyme structure and everything. Kind of on the existentialist end of things. Poetry throughout my teenage years became a form of self-expression and trying to understand myself. I had a teacher in eighth grade who. Who did a poetry unit, and that was where I really fell in love with it. So I still have all of my original poetry journals. And my first book was about 20 years worth of poetry, all just kind of crammed into one book. My second book was about 5 years. I shouldn't say all of my poetry, the best of. my second book was about 5 years worth, and both of those were published under my former name before I came out and transitioned. A lot, and the poetry CD was was mostly poetry from that first book as well. I think my writing has happened in stages. So I have years where I don't really write much and other years where it's very prolific, just kind of depending on what's going on in my life. Still how I process a lot of things. So I definitely don't put out everything that I do write, but but I do enjoy the process itself.
Any chance you can share a poem with us?
Sure. Let's see. I picked one out that this is one that I wrote in 2023 before I moved here, but after I knew that like things were starting to work toward me coming here. I think most people here know the Grove and Occidental. It's one of my favorite places to go, as well as Armstrong Woods. And this is just based on that idea that hit me about 3-4 years ago, that when I came to Sonoma County, I was coming home to myself. Mm-hmm. So I call it Backroads. I wanted to come home to myself, to feel myself raw and whole, to see the resilience of my roots mirrored in the burnt out hollows of ancient redwoods reaching up to seek the light, to hear the echoes of generations of joy and tears touch the shore as the tide comes in, to feel the stillness of my soul in the moments of solitude, and to reconnect with the quintessential elements of humanity untethered.
More. Oh my God, you got us on the cliffhanger. At least that's what I felt. I was waiting for like the next part.
Oh, that's so.
This is a really short piece. Wow.
So strong, so poignant.
I was just imagining the burned out trees reaching for the sky. Yeah. And everything you wrote was so, I could just see the visual in my mind, you know?
Yeah, no, imagery is a big part of that process for me. I'm a very visual thinker.
Very beautiful. Thank you so much. Yeah.
It's a coming out. I mean, I just feel like you're coming out and you just found yourself, you know?
You know, honestly, I feel like I'm always coming out and finding myself. I don't think that's, for me, it's a process that doesn't stop. So
there's more, right?
Yeah, there's always more. And I'm hoping that there's always more. I feel that like the day that there isn't more is the day that I don't have a purpose to be here. So I just assume there'll
be
more.
That's a pretty big statement.
That's a big statement. Well, it's making us think about things, huh, Sherry?
I mean, you know, some people are very happy just sitting on their front porch or sitting in the garden or something, you know?
Right.
Yeah, that's not you though. That's not right. Dale though.
I know.
Well, you know, I defend you, Dale.
I don't know. There are times that I wish I could be that, and there are times that I've tried to be that, but no, it's not really who I am.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, do you have family here?
Mm-mm. I don't. I do have some friends that you know I grew up with that live out this direction. And then the friends that I've made through KOWS and the like. So,
I want to just ask you, go back to your poetry. Mm-hmm. Do you have readings? Do you share it with LGBTQ community? You know, stand up or something? Yeah.
It's been a while since I've done readings. When I was on KVMR, I did poetry specials every year during April, which is National Poetry Month. And I would bring together poets from different areas, usually poet laureates. And from different counties in California. And, you know, sometimes they weren't poet laureates, sometimes it was just local poets, but bringing people together to talk about the process of writing and what poetry means to them, as well as sharing some of their work. So that was kind of a way that I stayed in the readings, but I think the last time I did an actual reading was before the pandemic. So it's been a while. So,
wow.
I hope
we got to set yourself up. I mean, I'm thinking of positive images. Do you know them?
Yes.
The young people? They probably would love to have you come in and share some of your pieces.
Yeah.
And you know, because it talks about your journey.
Yeah.
You know, that would be, wouldn't that be cool? You should contact Positive Images and say, Diana told you about it.
I plan on it. Like I said, I'm still just getting settled in the area.
Yeah.
And I think that once I'm licensed and, you know, start to establish my private practice, you know, have enough sense of what my time and schedule will look like, that I can, you know, start to open up into more community efforts.
Yeah. You got to pay the rent.
Right.
I know you got to work, pay the rent. Yeah.
Especially this day and age.
And that makes so much sense too, because I know how much studying has to happen before that big test, because Diana had to go through it.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of time. So good for you at setting your boundaries. Hey, listen, you brought a song for our music break.
I did.
And we were wondering if you would tell us the name of it and why you brought it, and then we're going to go ahead and play it.
Okay, so the name of the song is Exactly Where You Are. It's by Chris Matthews, who is a favorite artist of mine. I first met her at Kate Wolf Music Festival, and she's performed here in Santa Rosa at least twice that I know of. When I saw her earlier this year performing with Nancy Vogel, and she performed here, I think, 2 years ago with Mia Byrne at the Lost Church. She has a new album coming out this year, and her first single from that album will be coming out this week. This is not that song, but this song is special to me because I also had to perform at a house concert at KVMR in Nevada City. And after that concert, she took the train for the first time to her next gig. It was the first time she'd ever ridden a train. And this song came to her while she was on that ride. So if you hear it, you can hear the elements of the train in the song.
Oh my goodness, how exciting.
But the idea of exactly where you are, it's really about, you know, meeting people where they are authentically, and you know, keep helping me keep in mind that we all have the capacity to grow and change. So
beautiful. All right, everybody, enjoy Exactly Where You Are by Chris Matthews, and we will see you on the other side.
I've traveled all across this land, up the Gold Coast and back home again. Found common ground round every bend, and far fewer strangers. Princess drawing at breakfast with wonder in her eyes. An immigrant on the phone with her abuela saying goodbye. Planes and trains and buses too. No us and them, just me and you. And every person's like a book with a story yet to tell. A hidden gem buried deep within the depths of farewell. Hello, how's it going? How's your journey been so far? It's nice to meet you, nice to meet you, exactly where you are.
Welcome back to Living Proof. You just heard Exactly Where You Are by Chris Matthews, and we are talking with Del Phoenix. Del, thanks a lot for bringing that song.
Yeah.
It makes sense why you loved it so much.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So as we all know, we are listening to this incredible person with all the different talents, and there's more to come, y'all. So we want to know about you as a personal liberation coach. Tell us about that.
Right. Okay. So the personal liberation coach is kind of the coaching end of my therapy work. It's where people don't really need therapy, but want help in learning how to be more of their authentic selves. That's been a huge part of my journey in coming out and transitioning, you know, my recovery journey. All of that has intersected. And so sharing that on a slightly more personal level and less, you know, professional, therapeutic, structured level opens things up to, you know, more expression in general. I love everything expressive arts. So I grew up in a musical family. My grandmother was also a painter, and she primarily raised me. She was a music teacher. All the kids on that side of the family had a violin under their chin at the age of three. I spent more time switching instruments that I did getting good at one. So, you know, that's how I ended up in radio, I think, is I never became a good musician. I would be like an intermediate level, but I do still love to play music and I'm very connected to it. So
when you say play music, do you mean as a radio show host or as an instrumentalist?
As an instrumentalist, I still love to play, but that's not something that I take very many places. I think once in a while when I go to music festivals, I'll still take my cello and jam or my drum and jam with people. But for the most part, that's a very private part of my life, whereas radio is the more public presentation of how music and my growth journey and spirituality and all of that you know, come together. So, and that's what my radio shows are usually about, is that personal journey as well. Let's see. So also, I do paint and do, oh, goodness. Wow. Collage. I don't feel like I'm a very good painter. Like, my art is not what you would consider aesthetic art that you would see in a gallery. It's certainly not perfect, but it's very much about expressing what I'm feeling in the moment and, you know, just my overall experience. There's a story behind every piece. And on my website, I tell a little bit of that story and what each piece means to me. A few of my pieces have poetry intertwined in them. Some of them I have it directly on the piece, and other pieces I have prints where I've superimposed written poetry onto the painting. And that's just a way for me to express myself in multiple dimensions.
Are you, so, in your practice, do you help people learn how to paint and express themselves like you're describing?
Right. It's more about the learning. It's not so much the learning how to paint piece as it is about, okay, here are some tools. Let's, you know, try some and figure out what really resonates with you and do more of that. And we talk about the meaning of it and how that intersects with whatever's going on in their life that they're wanting to overcome or move forward. And so
you present different mediums for them to use in your sessions. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is my art supply room here, but I have a, you know, pretty decent supply of basic art supplies with, you know, clay and, you know, all things paint, oil, acrylic, watercolor, drawing materials, you know, things for collage, lots of different pieces.
That's great. And then so people come to your office, or do you do it over Zoom?
In Sacramento, they came to my office. So everything that I have here right now is just in my home office until
you get licensed.
An office here.
So will you be an art therapist, or just build in art therapy into your practice?
I've mostly just built it into my practice and then saved, you know, the rest of it for the coaching piece. I think for every, you know, maybe 10 therapy clients, I've had one coaching client, so it hasn't been a huge piece of it, but I found ways to do art therapy with probably half of my therapy clients. I don't want to seek art therapy certification. That's just not something I have time and energy for right now. But I like to incorporate that as a part of my practice.
So the coaching part, is that going to be a separate certificate license, or are you just going to have that's what you call it? Okay.
No. That's just what I call it. And like I said, it's not providing therapy, you know, per se. So also as a social worker, I'm all about resources. So sometimes it's just about tapping into our, you know, internal resources as well as our community and social resources.
Okay. So. Wow. So again, more talent coming out. Okay. Is there anything, other talents that we haven't heard yet before we move on?
I don't think so.
No, not yet. Maybe you think about it in a minute.
I don't think
right?
so. I mean, I know some things that I love to do, but I'm not great at. You know, like I love to cook, I love to garden, but I'm not great at either one. So.
But you dabble in it, though, right? So,
dabble.
Yeah,
I dabble.
That's cool. Yeah. So, as you were talking about music and how you learn music and stuff. Your grandma. I'm just curious to hear more about, we're curious to hear about your grandma and how she became your grandmother to raise you.
Oh, okay. So I am in recovery, and we know that addiction is a family disease. My father was an addict, and he got custody of me when I was born. We were removed from his home when I was 5, and I spent some time in foster care and then ended up with my grandmother as my main placement as a child. So I lived with her for about 7 years as a child, and she was in my life before that, quite a bit. In fact, I think that she was one of the most stabilizing forces of my childhood. And she was a force. So she was divorced in 1954 with 3 kids and put herself through grad school to become a music teacher. Her husband was in the army and was in Korea and left Korea and married somebody else. So, she had to pave her own way. And art was a big part of her expression outside of music for her deeper, more personal things that she wasn't able to articulate. So I grew up with her paintings. I have a few of them now since she's passed, but she and I didn't really come together with art as a connection until the last decade of her life. We started going out for drives, and I'd bring a couple of sketch pads with us and some watercolor pencils and things, and we would draw what we saw, whether it was the geese in a pond or trees or whatever. But we didn't ever really talk a lot about art. So she never had a lot to say. So she was always the quiet one. And she preferred that other people talk. And of course, I think that's why I talk so much. So she taught music in the high schools and then private lessons at home. She was also in the symphony and retired from the symphony as its longest sitting member. And then when she retired from the symphony, she started a community orchestra. So I think that's also where I get a lot of my drive from. I grew up with somebody who worked 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, and just constantly had that. And I've had to learn to have more boundaries with myself around that energy than she had, but I also see how that kept her going through most of her life.
What was her instrument? So, was she a violinist?
Mostly violin and viola. So she played viola in the symphony. She taught strings, but she taught mostly violin and piano at home. She had a couple of cello students and a couple of viola students.
Wonderful. And so when she started her community orchestra, she conducted?
No, she was actually a player, so she played viola in that as well.
So were you the only child living with your grandma at the time?
I was. My stepsister lived with us for, I think, a year, year and a half or so before she went back to her mom.
So were you your only child?
Pretty much. I have 2 half-sisters, and then I have my stepsister and 2 stepbrothers. And I only have a relationship with my eldest half-sister at this point in my life. So.
Is there something that's causing that divide, or?
Well, my stepbrothers have both passed. My stepsister and I lost contact, I think, in our early 20s. We haven't really kept in touch. And then I don't know where my other stepsister is. So like I said, addiction runs in our family, and that's a part of many people's story in my family. So, yeah.
Okay. I think it's really a beautiful thing. I know it's a hard thing, but beautiful thing to take a tragic circumstance, the trauma around it, and then build it into your life such that you can help other people recover from it and understand it and come out of it.
Absolutely.
You're like their guide because you've been there. Yeah,
pretty much. I mean, that's what I do as a therapist. I mean, I work with different modalities. My favorite is narrative therapy, which fits into, or well, expressive arts fits into narrative therapy very nicely.
What is that?
Narrative therapy is a form of therapy where it's all about telling the story and then learning how to reframe, that story into what you want. So There's a lot of different processes in it. One of the main things to understand about narrative therapy is that it comes from a place where everything is relational and focuses on multiple factors in our life that have an influence on our lives rather than our problems being personal and like pathologized, coming from, you know, being coming from within us. So we look at like the impact of the problem on our life. So like, you know, if I have depression, then depression impacts my life. And we might externalize depression as a character or, you know, to in the story rather than, you know, and look at how it affects me rather than I am depressed and taking on that identity of depression.
Mm-hmm. It's about changing the story, right?
It is. It is. And often overcoming those and sometimes even transmuting those.
Yes. Yes.
Is it too much for me to ask you to give an example? Because that's very interesting to make it a character in, and I'm thinking of like, I don't know, Bunny Rabbit or something that, I don't know. I mean, how does that work?
So trying to think of some pop culture examples. I want to put an asterisk on this because of the transphobic nature of the author, but Harry Potter is a great example of externalization where we can take certain aspects of characters and apply those aspects to different things that people experience. So, for example, the Dementors in Harry Potter could stand for depression or anxiety, depending on how the person relates to that part of their life. It very much aligns with the hero's journey as well. So like we can look at our lives from that perspective of what state, you know, what stages of the hero's journey are you currently experiencing and what do you want that to look like coming out on the other side as well. Mm-hmm. So
great, good important work.
Thank you.
It's really good, important work
to
change the framework and how we think about ourselves and how it becomes a negative and we change it up to be what we want it to be, like you're talking about.
Right. So.
Well, we're the narrators of our story.
We are. And I mean, regardless of what modality we use, you know, you and I both know as therapists, it's really just about the presence and the empathy, right? You know, being there with somebody and letting our own experience inform what the other person is going through without superimposing our experience onto them.
Exactly.
So, but just sitting in that space and allowing them to have their own process and guiding them through that with the questions, whatever modality the questions come from.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So looking at your whole life, it seems like your childhood has driven you to where you are in helping and supporting people and empowering people. I mean, that's
I think it has. I know for myself, when I look at different stages of my life, I've always had the support that I needed in terms of what I needed when I needed it. It wasn't always what I wanted. It wasn't always ideal, but it was what I needed. And so sometimes there's sirens in the background. Sometimes it just comes down to the basics of, okay, what do I have right now? What do I need right now? And how do I get that? You know, and when it comes to working with trauma, it's all about unmet needs at some point in our life and figuring out what those needs are and how we can provide those for the person. So my experiences inform that in different ways. And, you know, so as a queer person, my experiences as a bi person and dealing with bi erasure in the community, and as a trans person who's more on the non-binary end of the spectrum than the binary, you know, male or female end of that spectrum, if you want to call it, call them ends, it really informs, you know, my practice and my understanding of what other people are going through and helps me hold that space for them.
You used a term, I think I heard you say bi erasure.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I've never heard that term before. Can you describe or explain it?
So bi erasure is the idea that people who are bisexual or pansexual, which is how I now identify, are often erased because if they are in a homosexual presenting relationship, then the side that dates the opposite sex or has relationships with the opposite sex is not publicly seen. And vice versa, if they're in a straight presenting relationship, then their queerness isn't seen. And historically within the community, I came out in 1991, and I started hanging out at the Lambda Community Center in Sacramento, which was my safe space as a teenager. But at the time, that was the gay and lesbian center. People who are bisexual and transgender could be there, but we couldn't have our own groups at the time. There's a lot of history behind that, and I don't think we have time to go into that. But the bottom line is that, at that time, I remember dating people, trying to date people, and trying to date lesbians then was like, oh, you've been with men, or you still want to be with men? No, thank you. And having that energy, or being told things like, make up your mind, or, either stay in or come out of the closet, but, get off the fence kinds of messages around being bi. I don't hear those as much today. Thankfully, that was 30 something years ago, but I think those attitudes are still present in some spaces in the community.
I think I'm guilty of that. I had a friend, a woman, we had a friend actually, who was married to a man who kept telling us, I'm not straight. I'm bi. I'm not straight. I'm bi. And it's like, what are you talking about? You're with this guy. You've been with him for 30 years. I just did not get it. I really didn't. And I think what you're saying is so real, because if we don't see that other side, then it's hard to understand, but yet it's not really mine to understand. It's just to accept somebody who's talking about that's how they want to be identified. It's just tough to understand it, I think.
It is. It is. I think the lesson I've taken from doing my own work behind it has been to not assume that I know the full picture of how somebody else identifies and what their internal experience is.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, because I have the same, not just with that friend, but different people I talk to, because I like to know who we are, who we're talking to. And I want people to be upfront and honest with me about who they are. So, I try and talk about it early on in my relationships with people, to see where they land. Cause I feel like it's important to me, cause we could be honest and upfront and authentic, but there are situations where I can see a couple and I'm like, later on, maybe after some times of socializing, next thing you know, they make some comment about their like women or, or something like that. And it's like, they're with the man, like Cher was saying. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know. So my role now is trying to like talk about stuff early on. So I don't have to have that, but I don't have to assume either.
Right.
What you're talking about. So it's really interesting. Yeah,
same with gender. Like I shared earlier, I'm non-binary, but I present as transmasculine, and that's what's worked for my body, but that's not all. My body is not all of who I am, or how I see myself, or the roles that I play in my life. So, I have to look at each of those aspects to really get the full picture of who I am. And I don't have to share that with everybody either, but I think when we get to know people, it's important to keep that open mind that we don't know everything about them, and we can't make those assumptions. We can't always understand where they're coming from, and the vulnerability that it takes for them to share who they are and where they're coming from is a gift. And when we don't assume, we make it safer for them to be vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, and we try and be nice, easygoing people to invite people to show up and be comfortable, because we do this radio and we invite a lot of different people.
Yeah,
we walk up to strangers, and we just say, hey, we're radio show hosts and we would like to have you on our interview.
Right.
And our radio show, we did that yesterday at the African Soul Festival. We saw these two women with babies and I just went up to them and, hey, how you doing? I don't know if they want to be on the radio or not, but I introduced myself, and they were really cordial and nice, and we'd do it.
Nice.
And the kid was more excited than the parents, right? They had a daughter like maybe 10 or so. Really? Radio? Okay. I said, yeah, we could interview you guys as a family, you know? So yeah, it's just being open and welcoming, you know?
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, we want to thank you so much, Del. You've said some very important things today, and I think people will go back and rewind, and at least I am going to listen to your little words of wisdom here and there. And speaking of words of wisdom, we like to ask our guests, you know, do you have anything to share that if somebody were listening, and maybe a youth or maybe an elder? I mean, is there something maybe to both of those groups, or is there something that you'd like them to know?
You know, honestly, I think because we're talking about youth and elders, I think it's really important that we all have mentors that are older and younger than us. Because as elders, we lose touch with where youth are coming from, and youth are always bringing forward more truth, more forward movement in our society. And elders often have a tendency to get stuck in, you know, their own paradigms that they grew up in. And so it's great to learn from younger people, but younger people also need the wisdom of elders, you know, in terms of how to do the things and, you know, learning the traditions before learning, you know, what needs to be changed and what doesn't. So it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. So,
I like that idea of a mentor, a younger person as a mentor.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel that's really important. I have a 24-year-old son, and I learn things from him every time I speak to him. So.
What? What? We didn't know you had a son.
He doesn't live here with me. He's now in Seattle. So he's getting married next year and lives with his fiance. So.
Whoa. Yeah. That's a big piece of news about you that we didn't know.
Yeah.
That you saved to the very end.
Saved to the end. Yes. You didn't want to go there.
I feel like there's so much to kind of have to condense, you know, okay, what's the most important piece to share? Uh-huh. So.
Wow. So you,
well, I there's a lot of questions I have, but we are at the end of our show. Right. The one question I guess that's, I think listeners might have is, well, how did your son deal with your transition?
Oh. Well, he still calls me mom, which is hard. We've had some discussions around it. And like when we're alone together, it doesn't bother me so much. It's difficult in public because I get all the looks when that happens. So that's not so comfortable. But there was really no friction, no problem other than just the shift in language. Languaging that we're still navigating. So, and I've experienced that the shift in my name and shift in my pronouns have been difficult for most people that I've known over the years. And that's just because they have preconceived ideas of who I am. And it's harder to change those preconceived ideas than it is to, you know, like meet somebody for the first time and understand who they are. So,
yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So you'll be off to a wedding soon then.
Next April. Yeah.
Next April,
during poetry month.
I'll probably do some writing. And so I did have one other piece. You had asked me for a couple of pieces. And when
that'd be great.
I saw the words of wisdom, I was like, I don't know what I should say, but I picked one that kind of felt like it might fit that. Okay. It's called Sometimes. So I long for the days that I didn't know any better, when I didn't know what was missing, when I didn't know what was taken, when I didn't know what I'd given up, or simply what I didn't know. But today I'm grateful for the hard decisions, for the lessons forged in the depths of unknowingness, for the beauty in the awkward, and the perfection of right timing. Tomorrow has yet to arrive, and what will unfold is yet another unknown in a sea of possibility as I sit in the presence of what is.
Beautiful. Sit in the presence of what is.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dale. Yeah, it's been a pleasure getting to know you.
Thank you. Thank you. Honored to be on.
Yeah. We really want to thank you so much for being on our show. And we want everyone to remember that just like Dale, you too can be living proof that through being visible and vibrant and perseverant and finding your niche, you too can make this world a better world. This is Diane and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
good night.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.